Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Ben Flanagan of AL.com. Matt Scalise, editor of FilmNerds.com.
What's up, Ben?
Hey, Matt. I hear you're surrounded by screaming kids and we don't have much time.
Yeah, well, we should be okay on time, but there's definitely a boisterous crowd around me, which actually I had a little bit of that in my theater when I saw Spider-Man Homecoming. I think this is a movie that's probably attracted a younger audience than a lot of the other Marvel movies that came before it. Did you have a similar experience?
Not really, because I saw it before noon on Friday. So, yeah, which is when I like to see movies, so I don't really get the Friday night experience anymore, but for the, I guess, half-full theater crowd that I had there, they were into it.
Yeah, well, certainly it's done a lot of business so far. As we're talking about this, this movie is on pace to open with about $120 million in the U.S. for its opening weekend, so definitely a success for Marvel. They're strange partnership with Sony to reboot this franchise as a part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So I think, Ben, a lot of the questions we had going into this movie were involving, you know, whether this was going to work again. I don't think we've ever seen a third attempt at the same franchise property, a full reboot, a recasting, a retelling of who he is and who his surrounding characters are. So this movie, I think, had a lot of hurdles to get over with a lot of people. It seems to have done that critically so far and at the box office, but I certainly want to know what your opinion is about how Marvel tackled this very awkward challenge of rebooting Spider-Man once again at the movies.
You know, first of all, like you said, they had a good week with it. So I just want to say I'm really happy for Marvel in when these risks pay off, because they really need good things to happen to them.
And yeah, it's always good to see the little guy win one.
Yeah, it's always good to see it work out when they take such calculated risks, even with things like Ant-Man and Guardians of the Galaxy, and Guardians of the Galaxy 2, for that matter. So good for you, Marvel. It's interesting because I think Hollywood, more often than not, makes good Spider-Man movies. I think their batting average is really good so far. They were 2 for 3, obviously. And really, I would say 2.5 for 3 with the Raimi trilogy. And I actually like both of the Amazing Spider-Man movies, despite some of their obvious flaws. I think they're really entertaining movies, specifically, predominantly, because of Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone. Their chemistry is fantastic, but Garfield in particular, I think, just made a really good Spider-Man. And I thought the action was strong, and I thought Mark Webb did a decent job directing them. So, you're talking about 4 for 5 there with Spider-Man, and I really kind of like the direction that they were going with Amazing Spider-Man, and I would have been willing to go along with whatever third movie they had planned. But when they announced that they were rebooting it again, I was confused because of the success that those movies had. But then, you know, the idea or the fact that the character would be in the hands of Marvel Studios made more sense than anything, because, you know, as a longtime Marvel fan and seeing obviously what Marvel Studios has done with all of these characters in the cinematic universe so far, I think it's in the characters' best interest, just Marvel's best interest in general, for Marvel Studios to be in charge of them, as many as possible anyway. So if that means Marvel Studios gets their hands on Spider-Man from now on, great. If that means that they get Fantastic Four and eventually X-Men, then that just needs to happen. It all needs to be under the same umbrella at some point or another. So I think that was good news, even though I never like seeing a project rebooted over and over and as quickly as it's quickly turned around as this one was. But that being said, knowing that it was in Marvel Studios' hands, you knew they were in good hands, because I know that you and so many people, especially here within Film Nerds Unlimited and Film Nerds, think that Marvel tends to make really good movies, if not great movies, and they're really good at what they do. So we all knew that Spider-Man would finally be in Marvel's hands, but be in really good hands. And I think the result here is pretty terrific. It's a really fun summer movie, and it's honestly, Matt, and what I think is kind of a refreshing aspect of this, it's easily, I don't know if easily is the right word, because I mean you have something like Ant-Man and maybe one or two others. It's the lightest stakes Marvel movie, I think, that we've had up to this point, and there's really nothing wrong with that at all, because I mean, look, you're playing within the confines of a high school story and with high school characters, and yes, there are to an extent life or death consequences, certainly for some characters, but for the most part, you're talking about high school kids, and you have the idea that, you know, they're going to make it to the end regardless of what happens. And so I really like that, and it all starts with Tom Holland as Spider-Man and Peter Parker, and he's really, really terrific in this role, and we got a glimpse of that, obviously, with Civil War. But here now, the fact that this kid who has such limited experience, especially in a high-profile project like this, he carries this thing from beginning to end with a lot of charisma and likability, which is so key here for this character and so key for someone like Peter Parker. And again, I think Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield did terrific jobs, but Tom Holland, he slides right in just like those guys, and it's so refreshing to see a Spider-Man and Peter Parker at this age and to find an actor like him at that age who's able to carry the load is, again, it's really refreshing.
Yeah, Ben, I mean, I think I have overall a pretty similar feel about the movie coming away, but when I was watching it in the theater, I had kind of an interesting experience with it because I didn't really know what to expect. I tried to stay away from a lot of stuff around this movie. And going into it, I think one of my big concerns or hesitations was just how exactly they were going to handle tying it in to the rest of the MCU. We heard so much about how, you know, this character was kind of, it's been unclear how Sony wants to handle it, right? There's still kind of these vague suggestions out there that they kind of want to build their own separate movies around this guy. We don't entirely know what they're going to do. And really, as you watch this movie, I had a sense in the first maybe half hour that an awful lot of exposition was being devoted to tying this movie to the rest of the MCU. There's a lot of references to Civil War and to the first Avengers movie. Actually, the entire villain origin story is built on the first Avengers movie. So there's a lot of knowledge sort of required, I would say, of other Marvel movies. And I don't know. I mean, look, for me, I'm a huge fan. None of that bothers me. I think I had some reservations about it, watching it, just wondering, like, what about the people? How are people going to enjoy this if they don't really care necessarily how this ties into Marvel? And then what happens at a certain point is really once we start meeting the other characters outside of Peter Parker and Tony Stark, this movie just takes on its own life and its own character, and it's really unlike any other incarnation of Spider-Man in the movies, in comics, anything else that I've ever seen. It just created its own version of what Spider-Man and his little world could be. And it didn't seem to, I think there's plenty of tribute paid to the source material, but I think that's so cool that somebody took one of the most recognized characters, this character where we all know his origin story so well. I mean, it's arguably as well known as Batman's, I would say, as far as origin stories go. And they completely skip over it. We never really get these tiny little joke references to his origin. There's not really that much attention paid to trying to recreate all the other characters that are typically around Spider-Man in his life. There's no J. Jonah Jameson. There's no, his friends and girlfriends aren't really the same. They just created their own thing, and it happens to have a character in it named Peter Parker, who is Spider-Man, and he has an Aunt May. Outside of that, this doesn't really bear any resemblance to any other version of Spider-Man I've seen. And I think that's really cool and kind of bold of them to do that. And they didn't. That's why it doesn't feel like it's weighed down by being the third version of Spider-Man, because it really feels like its own thing for a lot of the movie.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, that's one thing I, for a long time, had been looking for out of comic book movies was shy away from the origin story. Let's get Batman 89, that Batman 89 attitude where you just jump into it, even though that movie obviously revisits, it sort of flashes back to the origin, but once you start that movie, he's already Batman, right? And so that's what's similar about this is once you start this, he's already Spider-Man. I mean, once we saw him in Civil War, he was already Spider-Man. When Tony Stark goes and visits him in Queens, he's already been Spider-Man, and they just sort of get right to it and say, okay, people know who Spider-Man is, so let's just, you know, get into a Spider-Man story. And that's something I really loved about this version. And I love that, not necessarily that there was no J. Jonah Jameson, I love that there was no Oscorp in this, you know, like that we've seen in the first couple of franchises or first stabs at Spider-Man on the big screen so far. Again, it's totally different. And you're right, like, there's a lot about this movie that wouldn't be possible without the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, the Michael Keaton character, I mean, he opens the movie, or really, like, the movie opens on the immediate aftermath of the Battle of New York from the first Avengers movie, where Michael Keaton is like a contractor who's there to clean up the Avengers building, and he is fired, but they're essentially fired and replaced by the Department of Damage Control. And so, a spurned Michael Keaton and his crew basically steal Chitauri technology, and later in this movie, sell it on the black market. And that's sort of like how and why they're villains. And so, speaking on Michael Keaton, and we can go in more depth here now or in a minute, I think he's great. You know, I loved hearing that Michael Keaton was going to be a part of this, and I just love that his renaissance continues because most of what he's doing right now is really good.
This is not a phoned in. This is not a, you know, God, who am I forgetting from Iron Man 2?
Mickey Rourke?
This is not a Mickey Rourke phoned in villain role. Like, this is, he's absolutely still doing his good work that he's been doing for the last few years here. And this is, man, I think you've already heard a lot of discussion about this being maybe the best Marvel villain that we've seen so far.
I certainly felt that way, and I think it's because Michael Keaton elevates what I think is so material, if I'm being honest. We had to sort of guess his motivation, again, sort of outside the fact that he lost a job and had to support his family somehow. So this honest businessman suddenly stoops to selling criminals super dangerous weapons on the black market, and he's just mean now. And so that aspect of it I thought was a little thin. It's not until much later in the movie that his character, for different reasons, gains a lot more depth, and it becomes a lot more exciting in terms of his relationship with Peter Parker.
Absolutely, and I would say, by that point in the movie, I kind of got to the, I had already reached the point where I thought, okay, these guys have actually figured something out. I think there are times, especially early, where this movie feels overwritten and like a lot of different people had a hand in it.
But because there are 19 screenwriters credited.
Yeah. But what's weird about it is it actually seems to gain more of a kind of individual and unique voice as it goes on. And it kind of peaks at the end, which is very unusual. It seems to find its voice as it gets further and further along. By the time we reach the point where there's a big reveal involving the Vulture, I was kind of already on board with what was happening in this movie, and it had sort of reached that point where it had its own voice to me. And when they kind of nailed that moment in the story, I was simultaneously excited. There was a big reaction in my theater, and I was kind of happy for the guys who made it. I'm like, good for you guys, you pulled it off. I think it's kind of a jaw dropper that I can't really think of another parallel where they pulled off something like that in another Marvel movie. It's hard to do. It's hard to make it genuinely surprising what happens in these movies, but it was, and it is great, Ben, because it does kind of parallel what is going on with Peter Parker. It's kind of the inverse of it. This is a guy who is doing what he's doing to protect his family, but he's doing, you know, he's doing bad things to protect them, whereas Peter Parker is, you know, running around anonymously doing all this stuff to keep the people he loves safe. So I think it's a well-chosen villain for the first installment of this character, and I think they put a lot of thought into that. I think that arc of it really works well. You know, and I think a lot of the other characters, too, outside of him work really well for me, too. I think Ned, the best friend, is really good, and that kid's really likable. They play around a lot with the kind of trope of the guy in the chair from a superhero movie, but they have fun with it. And, you know, I think that's great. I think his other friends, the little team of debate team nerds, are pretty great, including the two female characters. You know, I think one of them is clearly being set up to be a bigger deal down the road in this franchise. But I like the other girl, Liz, too, does a really good job. I think they're both this is just a cast full of likable actors. Tony Revolori has some of the best comedic moments in the entire movie.
Yeah, you know, it's nice to see Tony Revolori get a part in another high-profile project. But I'll be honest, it took me a minute to sort of get the joke of casting him as Spider-Man's sort of longtime high school bully nemesis, this character named Flash, because in the past, it's always been sort of this, like, tall, muscular jock-type character, and Tony Revolori does not meet that description at all. I mean, he's scrawnier than Peter Parker. And so it's sort of like the sort of intellectual version of Flash.
Yeah, he's a nerd bully.
Yeah,
and he's also, I guess, rich. But he has the probably the biggest laugh in the movie for me was there's a really well edited cut from him kind of explaining why he doesn't want to give Spider-Man his car to suddenly standing on the side of the road watching it drive away. It was a really. Like that point in the movie too, I think, is when they really start finding the sense of humor that this movie has, and just they're nailing so many jokes at that point.
Yeah, and this movie has a lot of jokes. You're right, and it's essentially a comedy, and you know John Watts has a really great control of the action and really balances that comedy extremely well. But just quickly going back to the stuff with Peter Parker and the Vulture character, like what's so exciting about this movie and their sort of dynamic in that big scene we're talking about is, I mean, that's like a set piece that takes place in a car with dialogue only, right? And like just sort of the tension that sets up, and it's all about the character and it's all about the dialogue. And that's what to me is so exciting, because you have these enormous set pieces like this big Washington Monument piece, and then later obviously where this you've got a crashing plane, and obviously there's the typical Spider-Man stuff and Vulture's flying around, so there's plenty of like requisite superhero set pieces here. But it's just crazy that the most exciting moment in the movie I can't think of the exact term for like the trope or the device or whatever they use, but it's all about, like, again, dialogue and character.
Yeah, it's a great scene, and there's quite a few scenes where if you pulled it out and you'd have no way of knowing it's from a Spider-Man movie. It's just a great movie scene that's well acted and shot well. I think it's a good looking movie. It's again, I mean, I'm admittedly a sucker for the Marvel look, but it looks like a summer movie and it feels that way too. It's fun. You know, I think they learned, I think they clearly, they're actually very direct homages to the first two versions of Spider-Man. So they clearly have some respect for him. And I think they learned a lot from those movies. You know, I think there's a lot of the cartoonishness from the Sam Raimi version. And I think, as you mentioned, to me, what made the Amazing Spider-Man movie so special and what made them stick out was they took that sort of teenage melodrama of it, where Peter and his girlfriends and their relationships was always such a big part of what Spider-Man was about. And it just really nailed that so well and had such great believable chemistry on screen. I think this movie has a good mix of both of those things and does them pretty well. Ben, the other thing I want to bring up about this is, you know, I think one thing that bothers you and I both about movies that are being built with a future franchise in mind, it's often done kind of ham-fistedly. I think The Mummy, probably a notable example recently, a movie that just got absolutely hammered for spending so much time obviously setting up other movies. I feel like this movie there's no question there's a lot being set up in here. But for some reason, it doesn't bother me as much, and it didn't feel like it took away from what else was going on from the actual story arcs going on in this movie. I don't know how you feel about that. And just in general, I think there's a lot less of the sort of obvious intrusion, even though the whole setup comes from this movie being part of the MCU story. It doesn't feel like it's having to shoulder a lot of the load of setting up other movies to me.
You know, it does to an extent. And I mean, that it's sort of a requirement for all of these movies to have at least a little bit of that. And it's nice to see when they try to do it as organically as they can, you know, where you don't just feel like you're watching a mini trailer or a trailer within the movie. And that happens plenty of times. And sometimes, you know, that's the kind of fodder that fans really eat up, and then they do it well enough to where you forgive them for that. So, you know, and we should also note that the post-credit scenes do not bother doing that. So stay if you want to. I mean, there's some funny gags there that sort of play to that. But, yeah, fair warning. But, no, I think, I guess that's – this is a natural transition into talking about, like, Robert Downey Jr.'s role in this whole thing. Because if I'm honest, I mean, anytime he appears on screen, it feels like, well, they had to set aside a lot of time.
He wasn't there. They shot it because he was just wherever he was at the moment.
Fit this into Robert Downey Jr.'s busy schedule, which is just Marvel stuff, by the way. So, like, it seemed like this would just fit pretty naturally. But to fit this in his schedule, they had to, you know, they shoot these scenes where it's just Tom Holland and Robert Downey Jr. and maybe Jon Favreau here again as Happy Hogan. So in that regard, I'm not saying it necessarily felt a little less authentic. Maybe it did. I don't know. But the scenes are still strong enough, and they carry enough of the thematic weight in terms of Spider-Man's eternal struggle. And, yeah, it does serve the purpose of the upcoming Infinity War movie and how big Spider-Man's role might be in that and how big his role might be on the Avengers. I think that you're kind of playing with two separate stories there to an extent, but, I mean, it's a subplot. And so to an extent, that's okay, and it's building character and you're learning more and more about this version of Peter Parker. I will say the future Spider-Man suit that they teased to towards the end of Spider-Man Homecoming, I don't like it.
Well, he didn't like it either. He turns it down.
He rejected it.
Yeah, I mean, I like that, actually. I like that that's kind of the movie summed up, I think, a little bit, or at least that's trying to be their message about what this movie is that this is sort of very insistently not a high-stakes franchise. This is supposed to stay small-scale and street-level, and they don't want Spider-Man to ever become a part of the big, giant, cosmic Avengers story that they're doing. And, you know, I think there's some of those scenes with Robert Downey Jr. work better for me than others. Some of them definitely felt tacked on and, you know, not as organic as the other ones. I like what they're setting up for this franchise specifically. And I think the best sort of sub franchises in Marvel have done a good job always of trying to tell their own story. You can argue whether or not Captain America kind of went off the rails with that with Civil War. But you know, the first two, I think they're telling a continuous story that's really good. I think this movie seems like it's very interested in being a part of its own franchise. It's tied into the other stuff. But there's stuff set up with Donald Glover's character, and there's stuff set up with you know, MJ, as she calls herself at the end of the movie, and a lot of the other characters that are, you know, there's a great final beat that kind of shows us that there may be a dynamic change with Aunt May at the end of this movie. So I think this did a lot to set up the next Spider-Man movie rather than be so interested in setting up the next Marvel movie necessarily. And I appreciate that about it. I'm okay with trying to build a franchise. I think if, as long as you're true to your own story that you're telling and you don't get so caught up in trying to set up other movies that are being made by your same studio, I think that's where you get into more trouble. Well, Ben, the big takeaway, I guess, just anything else about this movie from the look, the effects, the tone, anything else that we haven't talked about that really jumps out at you about this movie?
Yes, but I want to make a quick point about what you just said.
Yeah.
In a way, this is sort of the most like the Nolan Batman movies than any of the other Marvel movies are, or any of the other DC movies for that matter.
I'm curious where you're going with this.
Well, in that they sort of like took the bones of a very famous and familiar character and beloved character and sort of did whatever they wanted with it. And they gave us something from the mind of sort of the creators and the filmmakers here that sort of adhered to the spirit of the character, even if it strayed, I guess, from the specificity of the mythology that everybody is so very familiar with. So, like in Batman's case, in Batman Begins' case, I mean, we're not as used to seeing Batman as ninja, right? And
right.
Batman go through sort of the origin story that he went through there. And while this isn't an origin story, there are just aspects of this Spider-Man and Peter Parker that don't adhere again to the very, very specific and very familiar story that everybody's used to and that we got with the first two incarnations of Spider-Man. So in that regard, I think that this is similar to those Nolan Batman movies, even if the tones don't exactly match.
Yeah,
and
I agree. Yeah.
And the one thing I want to say about the tone, to answer your question, you know, it's interesting. We've talked here, and everybody in the film world has talked about this Lord and Miller controversy with Han Solo, and now, you know, everybody knows that Lord and Miller are, I believe, still on board to make an animated Spider-Man movie, and Spider-Man seems to be right in their wheelhouse. And I wonder if that's a result of Lord and Miller themselves, because I watch a movie like Spider-Man Homecoming and I hear the jokes and the pace of the jokes and the tone of the jokes, and they feel fairly influenced by things like 21 Jump Street and the Lego movie. They just feel similar to me. So like if you had told me Lord and Miller wrote this, I would have said, yeah, that makes sense. Because, I mean, if you look at a character like the one Zendaya plays, the MJ character you mentioned, like she sounds like a Lord and Miller character. I mean, she's
yeah.
just this very funny, very super modern character that speaks very super modern, like Twitter-influenced language, which, you know, in some ways contrasts a little bit with some of the other characters in this who are also very funny and very quick, like Ned and Peter Parker, for instance. But, I mean, you look at a character like Martin Starr's teacher, you know, who kind of speaks a very similar language. So I think it's just very interesting. I sort of sense Lord and Miller influence here, and I'm interested to see what they do with the character.
There's connections. The guys that wrote this movie, actually, they wrote it may be the only thing else that I've ever seen from them, but they actually wrote the sequel to Cloudy with the Chance of Meatballs, which was a Lord and Miller film. And so they were specifically hired previously to mimic the Lord Miller style. And that may be why part of why they got this job. And I don't know if Lord Miller were ever part of the conversation to work on Spider-Man Homecoming. They're obviously still involved in some aspect of the franchise. We don't think that's going to be connected to this, but we don't really know what Lord Miller are going to do next exactly. So I think you're right, though. They've clearly had a big influence on big franchise comedies, and they've been a part of some of the most successful ones from the past few years. This is a time in Hollywood where comedies are not necessarily operating under the same rules that they used to. They're not all automatically successful in a way that they were 10 or 15 years ago, and Lord Miller had a lot of success doing it their way. You know, kind of a combination of the improv-y feeling, quick-witted stuff with really well-directed action and kind of big-budget feel to it. So Yeah, I think they definitely had an influence on what the look of this was. There's also been a lot of talk that they wanted to try to do a lot of John Hughes homage. I don't know that I'd necessarily agree that it feels like that. There are some very clear, direct references to John Hughes, but I think that's probably about as close as they get to it. I think mostly what they did as far as a John Hughes feel goes is they just really wrote a believable, likable teenager, and that's not a given
right.
in Hollywood today. That's hard to do.
Yeah, it's a high school movie, so I guess the automatic comparison is John Hughes, right?
Right.
So I think, like, that idea is always more interesting than the execution itself. But I think Spider-Man Homecoming sort of stands out on its own. It's just so different and stands out among the rest of the Marvel Cinematic Universe in terms of, like, what type of movie it is, what kind of characters it has, what kind of stakes it has. So, again, it's even though most of the Marvel Cinematic Universe has been really good, it's kind of its own breath of fresh air. So, yeah, I really liked it. And, again, the best parts are Tom Holland and Michael Keaton. Like you said, his friend Ned, the actor who plays him, really good. It's interesting that Aunt May just keeps getting younger with each incarnation.
Like her, though. I think the jokes are all fair, but I thought Marissa Tomei is really likable. And
she's great.
It fits the character. And again, like I've probably mentioned it 3 times. I think she has one of the best individual moments in the entire movie, which is the last beat of the movie. It got a big pop in theater for sure.
One of my big favorite jokes in the movie is when Peter Parker is talking to Donald Glover and they talk about this deli that got destroyed in this botched bank robbery.
Right.
And Peter Parker says, best sandwiches in Queens, and Donald Glover mentions another place. And Peter Parker goes, it's a little too much bread. And he goes, I like bread.
Yeah. Donald Glover was good, like, subtle character in here. And for people who aren't massive nerds, there's basically a setup there for the guy who would become Spider-Man down the road when he references his nephew. But I don't know if that's just intended to be an Easter egg or if they're legitimately setting up more things. But I think it was kind of a fan service moment. It's a character that a lot of people wanted Donald Glover to play in a Spider-Man movie. So it could just be kind of a reference to that. But it was fun. I liked what he did and a lot of other people in kind of small roles. Martin Starr is another one you mentioned. I thought he was pretty funny in this too.
Yeah, and what's interesting, Matt, is the fan service is not very in your face. It's pretty subtle, and I think a lot of non-hardcore Spider-Man fans, it's going to go over their heads like it did mine. You know, I like Spider-Man. I'm familiar with sort of like the general Spider-Man universe, but I like the fact that I had to read about the Easter eggs a little bit later after I had seen the movie. That's good on it for letting the fan service be a little quieter. But Matt, do you like John Watts for this moving forward? Do you think he did a good job with the material? This is a guy who got the job after making one indie movie, which has been obviously a big trend in not just MCU, but other big franchises to let these indie directors take on these just like $200 million mega projects. Do you want to see him sort of take on Spider-Man moving forward, or would you like to see it in somebody else's hands?
You know, whether he, how much control he had, I could never know. But I think this movie, I come away from this movie feeling like it does have a very recognizable and individual voice to it. And I think you have to put at least a good portion of that on the director. I think he did a really good job. The performances are all good. So, and it's doing really well financially. So I'd say he's got a pretty good shot if he wants it. I'd love to see him continue on it. You know, in general, I think you go back and look at the first, you know, couple of rounds of Marvel movies, and there's things obviously that we love about those movies, but I think it's a very interesting time for these Marvel movies because they seem to be getting more, they seem to be taking, even as they're burdened more and more by the story and the world that they exist in, they're giving these guys kind of more of a feeling of an individual voice and their own kind of color and flavor, each of them. I just think about Guardians of the Galaxy 2 earlier this year. There's not any other Marvel movies that feel like that one. This one has a very different feel. You know, I certainly have expectations of a Taika Waititi directed Thor movie with the trailer we've seen coming out this fall, and then Black Panther next year. I mean, I think we might be. I hate to make pronouncements before half these movies come out, but we might be getting to a point where these movies get to breathe on their own a little bit more. There's no question Marvel is controlling what's happening, but I think they're aware and acknowledging the fact that if you make these movies feel different from each other, it's actually a good thing, and it benefits all of them together if these don't feel like the next chapter in a long, ongoing 20-part series. If they all feel like individual movies, they all benefit from that.
So I guess the last thing that is, where does Spider-Man Homecoming rank among Spider-Man movies?
You know, it's been a while since I rewatched a lot of them. I really like the first Amazing Spider-Man a lot, probably more than the average person. I was disappointed by the second one. That one probably falls towards the bottom of the pile for me, along with Spider-Man 3, which I pretty flat out don't like. You know, I need to go back and rewatch a lot. I certainly feel great about it right now. I think that I would probably still put Spider-Man 2 as my favorite, just because I think they just kind of do everything right in that movie, and it's got good villains and it's fun, and it was kind of everything about the first one just amped up and done better. I think this one might be my second favorite right behind it. And that's just right now, but I just think it does. I like everything, you know, all the things that I could complain about the other Spider-Man movies doing, that all the negatives about those, I think this one kind of just mitigates all of them. And you know, maybe it doesn't kind of necessarily take that sort of marquee blockbuster feel at all times, the way that Spider-Man 2 does for me, but I think it never really feels weighed down. It's not too dark, it's not too heavy the way that some of these other Spider-Man movies could get. It's lighthearted, and it's just kind of exactly what I wanted, I guess. So I'm probably a little biased because it ended up being the movie that I was most in the mood to see when I saw it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's up there. You know, that's kind of what I'm comfortable saying in terms of like where it ranks among Spider-Man movies. It's certainly above average, and it has so few cons. Like, I mean, you can nitpick it if you want to, but for the most part, it's pretty solid all around. So I think it's right up there with the first couple of Raimi movies. And I like the Amazing Spider-Man movies, but I think right now I would put this one ahead of Amazing Spider-Man 2. I'm in the middle of a rewatch of the first one of those, and I'm really enjoying that.
The thing I would say that's just since we're looking back at the franchise, the thing I would say is it's so hard to forget for me that anything else that Amazing Spider-Man and that franchise did wrong, the way that they play the relationship between the two leads is, I mean, it's as good as you will see chemistry between two leads in a movie. It's really hard to replicate.
Yeah, this does not have that. I mean, honestly, the chemistry between Peter and Ned is better than Peter and Liz.
Definitely. No, because I don't think Liz is that fleshed out of a character. I think she does a good job for what she is, but
right,
she's a short-term love interest in this.
Yeah, franchise. She's pretty archetypical high school love interest.
Yeah. I think they'll probably build towards something else with a different character later. But, I think that will always stand out to me about Amazing Spider-Man is whatever else they did with that movie. It's really hard to get two performances that are as likable as Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone in that movie. It's remarkable to see performances like that in a superhero movie especially. So it'll always kind of be memorable to me for that. And I think, too, you know, the first two Spider-Man movies basically invented superhero movies. The MCU does not exist in its with its tone and its look and the way that it operates and the way those movies are structured. Sam Raimi invented that. So it's hard to not give it some extra credit for that, too. But I do think just in the evolution of things that this movie learned from those two movies and learned from what they did well with the character, and it still didn't feel like it needed to check all the boxes. You know, it still felt free to do its own thing, and I think it's a better movie because of that.
I agree. I think the Raimi movie, the first couple of Raimi movies definitely maybe reinvented them in as we know them now. I mean, like, it's crazy to think that between the Burton Batman movies, and for that matter, the Schumacher Batman movies, and Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, there was nothing else that really hit like those.
They were flukes, so, you know. I think when Spider-Man, when Sam Raimi made Spider-Man, it seemed like everybody kind of suddenly realized, oh man, this is, needs to be like a genre. Like, we can do any superhero now. We can make a movie of any superhero now because he did this.
Yeah, the first one made like $100 million the first weekend, and I remember seeing that number, whatever it was, and thinking, holy shit, I didn't think that was possible, and now it's just...
And the CG was good enough, too. That was such a big part of it. There was a visual hurdle that Sam Raimi got Hollywood over with superheroes. And once we saw Spider-Man zipping around, it was like, there's no limit. You can do any character now.
Yeah, and a quick note here too, Matt. I'm as big a Michael Giacchino fan as there is out there, but I think the Amazing Spider-Man movies still reign supreme in terms of Spider-Man themes.
Well, look, I'm with you. It's kind of weird because there's stuff in the Amazing Spider-Man movies musicals that I don't like. I flat out don't like some of it. But the main theme, it's like all of the Zimmer, like, classical work is awesome. It is definitely way, way up there for me for superhero music. I'm not as much of a fan of kind of the really weird digital-sounding grunge.
Yeah.
Stuff that gets thrown around in there that kind of incorporates Itsy Bitsy Spider. That kind of makes me roll my eyes a little bit.
No, I agree.
Second one. But yeah, it's really, really great. I think was it Danny Elfman did the original Spider-Man score?
He did the Raimi trilogy.
Yeah, I really like that stuff too. And I think, yeah, as far as comparing it from the previous Spider-Man movies, definitely I think that's a lot to live up to. But
he did great, though.
I really liked it. I liked the Giacchino score. It has a very recognizable little plucky theme to it that fits the tone of the movie really well. I think he has done two Marvel scores now that I've enjoyed a lot and I think have recognizable themes in them. So
oh, yeah.
I hope he keeps getting more work with them.
Yeah, his Strange score was awesome, and he does really good work here. And there's nobody better in the business than adapting really super familiar themes like of old into something really fun and exciting. Like Giacchino did it for Star Trek. Obviously, he had a lot of fun with Rogue One and the Star Wars themes there. But there, like what he does too with the original Spider-Man theme song at the very beginning of this movie is really good. So
he
does a lot of really
cool
work.
Yeah, and he actually rolls the Avengers theme in a couple of times too in a nice way. He's good at this, man. He's one of the best ones we have. So I'm always excited when he gets to work on a recognizable big name property. And he's not doing the next few Marvel movies, it looks like, but I think hopefully he'll get a lot more work down the road with Marvel.
Well, so another Marvel movie is pretty good, so I guess you're happy.
Definitely. It's keep it rolling, man. I got to watch two trailers for the next two going into this one, and I have yet to hit my ceiling on this stuff yet. I want more. I feel like if it's ever going to reach the point where I say I'm full, it'll be Infinity War. But if we make it through that and
yeah,
I'm still I'm still hungry, then it'll never stop.
All right, man. Well, I haven't heard any screaming kids in a while, so you might want to go check on the situation.
Yeah, that's usually not a good sign, so I better go take care of that.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.